supposed to think to yourself what it is that we're supposed to gain from the experience, I think it certainly behooves us to settle down for a moment in the last moments of Kanaka and to try to determine what it is that we were to have gained and how we can perhaps derive something that is usable for our day-to-day lives from the experience. Today, many of you may not realize it, but because of the parsha that we read today, which goes besos Kanakat HaMizbeach, and talks about after the Nesim brought the Korbanos, the Torah puts them all together and says, and this is the total of the dedication of the Mizbeach. Because of that, today is called Bezos Chanukah. So Minag in Yisrael, if you write a letter, you date it, you know, the day of the week. If it's Wednesday, you say Wednesday, Bezos Chanukah in the year. And it's a little unusual that we make such a big to-do about the aspect of Chanukah that's called Chanukah, because the funny thing is that really Chanukah has nothing to do with the Chanukah from Mizbeach. It was very much an aside to everything that happened. In other words, there's only two things really that we talk about on Chanukah. One of them is the actual fact of victory, and the other one is the miracle that took place subsequent to that victory, which is the Hadlakas Neros. And there's not a mention made about anything that has to do with Chanukah HaMizbeach. Except it happened to be that at the time, among the other things that were done when they went back to the Beis HaMikdash, they restarted the Aveda, and they had to rebuild the Mizbeach because the Greeks had been Mishakits. So the question is, why in the world we call the Chag Chanukah? Now, you could say we call the Chag Chanukah because, as many people explain, it means really Chanu B'Chofei, that they rested on Chofei B'Kislev, and that was the day that they lit the menorah. But I don't think that anybody can deny that if we call it Zot Chanukah, and we read the parsha of the Chanukah Samishkan, and obviously we're calling Chanukah Chanukah for some reason, because Chazal saw fit to encourage us to view Chanukah as something to do with a process of chinuch. That is to say that Chanukah somehow revolves around the concept of education, or deeper than education, because chinuch really has a much deeper meaning in English than education. Chinuch in Hebrew, rather. Chinuch in Hebrew does not mean education. There's no word for education in Hebrew. The word is chinuch. In chinuch, when you translate it into English, what does it actually mean? If you would say Chanukat HaMizbeach in English, what would you call it? A dedication, right? So we always talk about chinuch not in terms of study. We talk about chinuch in terms of dedication. And that's really, even in English, the word dedication has two meanings. You dedicate something that is to be used for a future, and you become dedicated, that is, you identify yourself, you see this as being what you have to do in life. And I think that relates very much to what it is we're to derive from Chanukah. If we see that Chazal were koveya, that the inyanim of chinuch are to be derived from Chanukah, then it would appear that all of those other things that we discuss, such as the kanos of Chanukah, the mesiras nefesh of Chanukah, all of them, the tikkun of the machlokes of Chanukah, which is really its makom, as we've shown throughout so many shiurim, all of these things somehow revolve around the concept of chinuch. And why is that? Well, you remember your old Kabbalah about Chanukah being feet and so on, right? Hod being one of the feet. I'm sure you remember all of that. But the two Yomim Tovim Derabanan are feet. And I want to show you that the same thing is true in English. There'd be nothing more that you could compare Chanukah to in English than feet. And the reason is very simple. Kanos is the ultimate act of independence. And that can be seen in many ways. And remember that we always mean kanos as opposed to fanaticism and as opposed to kin'ah, which is jealousy, because they're opposites. fanaticism and jealousy are one and the same. Kana'ut is the opposite side of that same coin. Why is it the ultimate act of independence? Well, for on a simple level, it's independence because you don't care about what people are going to say. You don't care about what the responses are going to be. You're independent enough to determine that this is what's going to have to be done, and you don't care what the consequences are. Now, that's a very independent stance. On a deeper level, it's independent because you had the independence to make the decision as to what had to be done. And that is an even greater degree of independence. After all, the willingness to act per se can be an act of great non-independence. If the Reverend Moon tells somebody to jump off a cliff and he goes and jumps off the cliff, that is not an act of independence, although it may be an act of great mesiras nefesh. But the independence in it is lacking entirely. But there's a deeper aspect to the independence of Chanukah, and that is something which derives from the very source of Chanukah. You remember that Chanukah is Choshech. The Greeks are Choshech. And Chanukah, of course, the or of the menorah, is symbolic of a victory over Choshech. And this was a Choshech whose source is in the very first part of Bereishis, V'choshech apnei tahom. Choshech apnei tahom, Chazal say, is a remes to the coming interaction, the coming cultural machloket that we are going to have with Greece. And the source of this machloket, the source of this darkness, is the fact that Klal Yisrael became Hellenized, as opposed to any of our other goliot. In all of the other goliot, we were not face to face with anything other than a clear-cut adversary. We knew what it was we were dealing with. There was an attempt made to destroy us physically, religiously, but it was clear-cut. It was anti-Jewish. With the Greeks, we were faced with a situation that was confusing. And it was so confusing, as we've explained in Shirim in the past, because of the fact that the Greeks are so similar in terms of their appreciation and approach to the Olam, to Klal Yisrael, that their values became easily confused with ours. And this goes back to the very source of Yavan, because we know that Shem and Yefet, the mocker of Shem and Yefet, in terms of their response to their father, was very much the same. So much the same that Chazal or even Koveya their Skar in saying that Yefet was Zoche to a Beged Noah, to beautiful clothing. And Klal Yisrael was Zoche to tzitzis on that clothing. So we see that Chazal gave us there an indication of the difference and yet of the great similarities between the two of them. The only way for us to have been mitgaber, for us to have triumphed over that cultural battle that Chanukah represented, was by clarity. And that's what the aura of the menorah represents. And that is the greatest independence imaginable. And this is why it's like feet. As you say in English, you've got to know where you stand. And that's what it means. When we say you've got to know where you stand, we're talking about the ultimate act of kanot. You stand, obviously, on your feet. That's where you stand. And that's why Chanukah is keneged hod. Knowing where you stand means that you are willing to dedicate your life, your very existence, to a certain set of values that to you mean everything. And those values are the source of any act of kanos. They are the height of independence, because one who lacks those values, instead of being a kanoi, becomes a mikane. He becomes someone who is jealous. Because anything that anyone has, after all, may really be his. And he's brokenhearted at seeing something that another person has that he doesn't have, because he feels that it's taking away from his world, being as he doesn't know what his world is. The opposite of kin'ah is kana'ut. And that is the most clear-cut definitions of what my world truly is and what my values are. And that type of definition leads one to taking the most independent stances. And a stance is also, of course, to stand. the most independent stances imaginable in dealing with whatever situation the world presents to me. And as such, if you'll think about the story last night, one of the elements of the story was the difference between the Western concept of education and the Jewish concept of chinuch. Chinuch cannot mean training. You cannot train somebody to put on tefillin and expect them to put on tefillin when the world in which he lives is a world that is anti-tefillin at its very source. The only meaning of chinuch is a sense of an overall clarity as to what my world is, in the sense of what my values are. And from that, everything else follows automatically, the tefillin and all of the other mitzvahs that come along with them. You cannot be mechanech someone just to do, out of the logical necessity and requirement for doing. You can be mechanech only by building the clarity, whether it be in a child or an adult, of dedication that comes from recognizing that this is the only world that I can have and that I desire to survive within, and that any other world is not worth living in, and therefore I will be moser nefesh for that world. And at that point, you break through the apparent barriers that confine you to what you supposed to be before your act of kanaus, what you supposed to be the real barriers of your world, and you find out that they weren't there at all. They were self-imposed. And if there's one thing that one can learn from Hanukkah, then it's this quality of recognizing that if you are to be successful in your own education, so to speak, then you must recognize that your goal is not to become educated. Because to want education means to reject everything that is meaningful. There's only one thing that you must want, and that is chinuch. Dedication. Education is counter-Jewish. So that if you're going to succeed in becoming a ben Torah, and succeed in becoming all that you came to yeshiva to become, it is only if you stop dividing your world into little pieces and saying, I will address this issue at one time and a different set of values another time. That cannot be chinuch. That is the opposite of Hanukkah. And that ultimately can lead as well even to minus. To succeed, you must realize that all of education is one vast dedication, not education. And that where you are going has everything to do with what you are doing right now. And what you believe in overall has to be the source of every action that you take at every moment. That is the meaning of Hanukkah. That is the meaning that is of the aspect of the chinuch of Hanukkah. And therefore, it is something that you have to work on in your entire approach in the yeshiva. I think it's very fitting for Zos Chanukas of Tovshin Mem Alev that we mention this. And it's fitting as well in recognizing that, after all, it's only an entire environment that can give a person a recognition of this chinuch. That the yeshiva embark on a program of changing the subconscious parameters of our particular world. As you know, each language has within it a great many assumptions. The axioms of a language are expressed in the way that a certain word conjures up an image in the mind. Every language, you could say the same thing in different languages. Every language will have a slightly different emotional context, a slightly different cultural bias of what that particular action means in that particular language. Some languages are generally warm, and some languages are generally cold, and some languages are generally technical, and other languages are generally vague, and so on and so forth. But more than the generalities, there are times when there's a perfectly good term in English for a concept, and yet we insist on using a French term or a Latin term. Is there a reason for this? Yes, there's a reason. Because the particular thing we are trying to say is a derivation of a concept that can only be properly expressed in another language. It's the power of language that made it even important for Moshe Rabbeinu to translate the Torah into 70 languages. And the Torah calls that itself Ba'ar Hetev, to make it clear, to view the various cultural possibilities that are inherent in Torah. It must express itself in all of these variants And only then can you grasp the richness of expression that is comprised in the one language that includes them all, which is Lashon HaKodesh. In order for us to live within the cultural mood of our Lashon, of Lashon HaKodesh, it is important for us to recognize that we also have to begin changing the bias of our language. There are certain things which, if said in English, absolutely smell and stink and reek of Christian concepts of religiosity that are so antithetical to everything that Judaism is, that if one attempts to read a sefer that is translated into English, one can feel like puking. And it's because English is not suitable for expressing things that are as delicate and as sweet and as deeply meaning as our connections with HaKadosh Baruch. And the Lashon that is really suitable for this is only Lashon HaKadosh. And thus we prejudice ourselves and destroy the opportunities that we can have in actually developing those relationships if we insist on maintaining a English-speaking attitude towards everything around us. So that if we're mispalel, we take a look at the tefillah and we think to ourselves, what does it mean in English? That's awful. You cannot be mispalel in English fully. You cannot translate a tefillah and have it mean what it means in Lashon HaKodesh, ever. Besides the fact that never would you be able to incorporate the richness of the variations that Lashon HaKodesh has, which is why every word can be darshaned in so many different ways and exist on so many different levels. You cannot even express the simplicity of the Lashon HaKodesh in English, or in any language for that matter, except, interestingly enough, Greek, which in Sefer Torah is kosher. But we won't talk about that now. So, we thought it was the best possible time, once everybody is mechunat from Chanukah and recognizes what Chanukah is all about, that we begin a program to change our overall structure of thinking by changing our language. I will not pretend that the syntax structure of modern Hebrew is truly Lashon HaKodesh, because it is not. It has unfortunately absorbed all too many of the prejudices of the technological world in which it was born, and has become, to some extent, a language tainted with Western civilization. Nonetheless, in it is incorporated a very large percent of at least the shorashim, the basic meaning of words that derives from Lashon HaKodesh. And knowing this language will open you up to being able to identify with the feelings of Lashon HaKodesh that are expressed in the tefillos, in the Kitzvei HaKodesh, throughout Tanakh, and throughout the Gemara that you're reading, and so on and so forth. Nothing could be more important than taking out this time to do a good job, to lose your fears, and to start living a day-to-day life that is based around the concepts that are so basic to our world, and that are so different from the English concepts. And the difference between tefillah and prayer is so clear. And lechem and bread is so clear. And so many different things, each one of which makes a little impact on you every time you say it, that perhaps you're not sensitive to recognize, but in its totality is there and is powerful. And so we were fortunate enough to find what I believe is the perfect individual for this program. And I don't say that because he happens to be sitting here next to me. I say that because I have been deeply impressed. On the one hand, Professor Pardes, otherwise known as Paradise in English, but here he's going by Pardes, is himself an American, has never lived in Israel except for a brief period of where he had a sabbatical from the university where he is a professor. And therefore, I think you can identify a little bit more with the fact that you're not just talking to somebody who happened to have been born in a Hebrew-speaking environment. You're dealing with an individual who dedicated himself and his family's life to growing up with his children in a completely new environment within the overall context of modern-day America, and went out to learn Hebrew and discover Hebrew, on his own to the point where it became his lifetime concern. I think that's very important. I think the fact that he can identify with you and with your own cultural views and biases, that will enable him to be a tremendously effective person for you. I think the fact that he is extremely perceptive and recognizes and identifies with your own enthusiasms and power and intensity. He told me before, I'm sure he'll mention it to you, that he was literally shaken when he walked in here because he didn't think that such institutions could exist. But he has never seen such intensity and such obvious power and dedication. And therefore, he's extremely enthusiastic. And I caught that enthusiasm over the telephone. And that's why I felt this has got to be it. I think that he will communicate all of this to you. But you have got to be willing to go through the pains of cutting your teeth on what is, to some extent, a new language. I think you'll be shocked to find out how much you really know once you allow yourselves to get over the embarrassment of talking Hebrew to your friends, which won't take more than a couple of minutes, if the classes are arranged the way I've been told, and you'll just go in and throw yourself into it. You'll be shocked, I'm sure, to find that it's very, very natural. We want to be doing it all the time. We want to change our notices to Hebrew, the Chazor sheets to Hebrew, the Bechinas to Hebrew, the works to Hebrew. At least anyway, let's try it out for these 10 days. Talk to your friends over the sinks in the bathroom in Hebrew. Talk to your friends on your bicycles in Hebrew. Talk to your chavrusa in Hebrew. And if there's got to be a word that you can't say in Hebrew, fine. We will not punish anyone by sending him to a shik center for forgetting English. However, if you insist on speaking English for any length, you must do it in Zilog. And I think I have spoken quite enough, and now I will give the floor over to Professor Yonatan Pardes. And this was the last Hebrew word, English words that you're going to hear for a while, so shalom v'leitrot.
Erev Tov, Mar Phelps. Ani roesh ze hador shelo makir et Mission Impossible. קודם כל, אני רוצה לומר שקשה לי מאוד לדבר עכשיו אחרי שאני שמעתי את דברי רב מתיס, מפני שזאת הפעם הראשונה בחיים שלי שאני שומע מישהו מדבר על העברית, אהבת השפה העברית, כמו שהוא דיבר עליה. אני מדבר מזה 20 שנה, אולי יותר, על הדבר הזה. שנה בחיים שלי, שיש לי אפשרות לנסות לתרגם את הרעיון הזה למציאות. כמו שרב מתיס אמר, אני ואשתי החלטנו לפני 19 או 20 שנה שאנחנו נדבר עברית בבית עם הילדים. ואולי אתם רוצים לדעת למה החלטנו לעשות את זה. אולי אתם חושבים שזה היה מפני שרצינו שהם ידעו עוד שפה, שהם יהיו מה שקוראים באנגלית bilingual, דו-לשוני, שהם ידעו יותר משפה אחת. וזאת לא הסיבה. הסיבה שעשינו זאת היא שרצינו שהשפה הראשונה שלהם תהיה עברית, שכל האסוציאציות, זאת מילה עברית עתיקה מאוד, שכל הרגשות שלהם, במיוחד הרגש האינטימי, הרגש הראשון, הרגש שקרוב מאוד ללב, שהרגש יהיה בעברית. ואפילו ידענו שפה באמריקה השפה החזקה יותר אולי תהיה אנגלית אחרי שהם גדולים, בכל זאת רצינו שהשפה של הבית תהיה עברית. וכל הערכים האלמנטריים והקרובים והחשובים גם כן עברית. וכל זאת התחיל לפני כ-20 שנה, כשנודע לנו שאשתי הייתה בהיריון, ומאז ועד עכשיו אנחנו עוד לא דיברנו אנגלית עם הילדים. ובהתחלה זה היה קשה מאוד, כי אני לא ידעתי כל כך הרבה עברית אז, ואשתי ידעה פחות עברית ממני ודיברה בהרבה שגיאות, ופשוט היו הרבה מילים שלא ידענו. כשאני מסתכל פה מסביבי בחדר הזה ואני רואה שם את המקרר של פפסי, ואני מסתכל במטבח ואני רואה את כל הדברים במטבח, כל המילים האלה אנחנו לא ידענו. אבל לאט לאט למדנו את המילים והתרגלנו לדבר בעברית. ובהתחלה זה לא היה נוח, זה הרגיש מאוד פוני, לא טבעי, כי הרי עד אז כל דבר שאמרנו היה באנגלית, ופתאום אנחנו החלטנו לעשות דבר שהוא ההפך מטבעי, הוא מלאכותי. הוא לא היה אולי הגיוני, אבל עשינו את זה. אני חושב שיש הרבה דברים בחיים שלי שהם לא הגיוניים. אני לא יודע בדיוק אם זה הגיוני לא לאכול בשר וחלב ביחד. אינני עושה את זה. אינני יודע אם זה הגיוני, אבל אני עושה את זה. כלומר, יש הרבה דברים שהחברים שלי לא מבינים. הם אומרים זה לא הגיוני. בשבילי יש כזה היגיון, אבל בשבילם אין היגיון. אבל זה הדבר שאנחנו עושים בעצם בכוח הרצון, בכוח האמונה, ולא בכוח ההיגיון. טוב, לא באתי לקליפורניה כדי לספר לכם על החיים שלי, ואני לא רוצה לדבר יותר על זה עכשיו. אני הערב מלא תקווה. לפני שבאתי הנה לא ידעתי בדיוק זה יהיה אפשר במשך 10 ימים לעבור מאנגלית לעברית. אחרי שהייתי פה 2 שעות, 3 שעות, כבר התחלתי לחשוב שבאמת אולי זה אפשר. למה? כי הייתי בחדר האוכל הזה, אתם קוראים לזה חדר אוכל או יש איזה שם אחר? זה חדר האוכל? תודה. ושמעתי איך שאתם שרים. קודם כל שמעתי איך שהרב פורטו שר בקולו החזק והאדיר, וראיתי איך שאתם עונים לו, ואז קמתם מן הכיסאות והלכתם שם לרקוד, ואני חשבתי ש... שהקיר ייפול.
איזו התלהבות,
איזה כוח, איזה רוח.
עכשיו, אני, כשהייתי צעיר, אני הייתי בארגון בשם USY, וגם ב-USY הם דיברו על רוח. אבל אני תמיד חשבתי ששם הפירוש הרוח זה... וכאן אני הרגשתי רוח אחרת. ואני לא יודע עדיין אם אני יכול להגיד במילים את הפירוש של הרוח הזה, מפני שאני רוצה לומר לכם שזאת הפעם הראשונה שאני יושב בישיבה. אני לא יודע מה זה ישיבה. היום שאלתי היום את הרב מטס אם הישיבה הזאת היא כמו כל הישיבות באמריקה, כי אני לא יודע.
אם כן, אתה הולך לישיבה?
רציתי לחפש את הארנק שלי להוציא את הכסף לשכר הלימוד, אבל הכפתור בכיס סגור. מה שאני מרגיש, מה שהרגשתי אמש מיד, הוא שאתם יודעים מה זה שורש? הרגשתי שיש כאן שורשים לרוח, שזה לא רוח שעוברת. ואז אני נכנסתי אחרי הארוחה לבית המדרש, ושם למדתי. אני רוצה לספר לכם שאף פעם בחיים שלי לא חשבתי שאפשר לקרוא כל כך מהר. וכאן אני חושב שיש סכנה, מפני שאין כל כך הרבה ללמוד, אתם תגמרו את כל מה שיש ללמוד לפני סוף הלימודים. ראיתי, בקיצור, אני ראיתי שבאמת אתם יודעים הרבה. ואני, כמו שאתם יודעים, מדבר עברית מודרנית, אבל העברית הזאת היא לא כל כך מודרנית. אתם שמעתם על הקנאי הזה, אליעזר בן יהודה, שעבד כדי להחיות את השפה המדוברת. יש אנשים שאומרים שאליעזר בן יהודה החיה את השפה העברית, נתן לה חיים. אבל לומר שהוא נתן לחיים, פירוש הדבר שהיא הייתה מתה. היא לא הייתה מתה. וגם היום אצלכם היא לא מתה. היא בתוככם. אתם יודעים הרבה מאוד. וזה מה שנתן לי תקווה. אולי מה שאני אלמד אתכם בעשרת הימים הבאים יהיה קצת חדש, אבל לא לגמרי חדש. יש לכם הרבה מרץ. הפירוש של המילה היום, מרץ, הוא אנרגיה, אנרגי. השורש מרץ, מרש צדי, מופיע בתנ"ך. דוד אומר ששמעי קילל אותו, הוא קיללני קללה נמרצת. והיו אנשים שחשבו שהפירוש של הפסוק הזה, קללה נמרצת, קללה חזקה שיש בה הרבה מרץ. היום אנחנו יודעים שהפירוש של מרץ הוא ההפך, לא משהו חזק וטוב, אבל משהו כמו חולי, כמו מחלה, שאתה חולה מזה, כמו המילה בארמית ממרש עין, מרע, כמו שטיף מרע, שאולי למדתם על זה. אבל המילה היא אותה מילה. זה קרה הרבה פעמים בעברית, שהפירוש השתנה בעברית המודרנית, ויש תמיד, יש כל מיני סיבות, אבל את המילים אתם יודעים.
ומה שאני מקווה שאתם תעשו הוא ככה, שתפתחו את הפה, שתשתדלו לדבר וזה יהיה גם כן תענוג. זה יהיה כמו שאומרים בעברית, בעברית הערבית, כיף. זה יהיה פאן. אני חושב שמפני שאתם כבר למדתם כל כך הרבה, שזה קרוב לנו, שלא בשמיים, שאנחנו יכולים להשיג את המטרה הזאת. מה אם אתה רוצה להגיד משהו ואתה לא יכול ואתה משתגע, אתה מתפוצץ, תגיד את זה באנגלית, את המילה הזאת או את המשפט הזה, שום דבר לא יקרה. אתה לא צריך לצום 40 יום, אבל העיקר הוא כל הזמן לחזור אל העברית ולהגדיל יותר ויותר את הכוח שלך בעברית. אנחנו נשיר בעברית, נצחק בעברית, נתלוצץ בעברית, נציג הצגות בעברית, נשמע וידאוטייפים בעברית. זאת מילה עתיקה מאוד, וידאוטייפ. הלא כתוב בחומש, ויאמר משה אל אהרון, איפה הוידאוטייפ? איי הוידאוטייפ. אין בית בלי יסוד, אין בית בלי מבנה, והמבנה של העברית הוא הדקדוק. אני רוצה לעזור לכם בימים הקרובים לבנות, לסדר, לערוך סדר בראש שלכם, ואז יהיה הרבה יותר קל גם. ודבר אחרון, אני רוצה להראות לכם שכוח היצירה של העברית עוד חי וקיים, שעוד נמשכת השרשלת בתרבות העברית. ולכן אני רוצה גם כן להביא לפניכם כמה פירות מן התרבות העברית של ימינו, בשיר ובסיפור. אלה מטרות שלנו, אלה היעדים שלנו, אלה הדברים שאנחנו רוצים לעשות אותם. זאת רק התחלה, אנחנו לא נגמור, אני מקווה שזה ימשיך הלאה והלאה והלאה. אני מקווה גם כן שנזכה לעלות בישראל ו לקשור קשר, קשר עברי עם הארץ ועם היהודים בארץ, וגם לקראת המטרה הזאת נעבוד. האם אתם יודעים מה זה ניסיון?
אני מתכוון לפירוש של ניסיון, שזה מבחן, כמו הניסיון של אברהם אבינו. זה ניסיון, ואנחנו שמשתתפים בניסיון הזה אולי חושבים שאנחנו בפינה קטנה של קליפורניה, ושזה רק העניין שלנו. אני רוצה לומר לכם שזה לא כך. יש אנשים בחוץ באמריקה שיודעים על הניסיון הזה בסנטה קלרה. הם מעוניינים בפרויקט הזה. הם רוצים לראות אם נוכל להצליח. ואם אנחנו נראה שאפשר לקחת בחורים שיודעים טקסטים, שיודעים מקורות, שיודעים תורה, ולהביא את העברית, לא, צריך להביא, להוציא את העברית מן הגרון והחוצה, כלומר שהם יוכלו להיות ישיבה עברית, מוסד עברי, אז הם ירצו לנסות את זה במקומות אחרים. אני אספר לכם דבר. דיברתי עם אדם שיושב בניו יורק, ורק דיברתי איתו רבע שעה בטלפון על הישיבה שלכם, הוא כבר אמר לי, יאללה, אני רוצה לסדר איתך עוד דבר כזה בפסייף ניו ג'רזי, ויש לי גם כן עוד אפשרויות. הוא מעוניין בזה. יש לנו אם כן אפשרות ליצור, וכאן אני אלמד אתכם אולי המילה החדשה הראשונה שלכם, ליצור תקדים. תקדים זה precedent, מן המילה קודם. עד כמה שידוע לי, קודם לא היה דבר כזה, לא היה עברייה. זאת הפעם הראשונה. אם אנחנו נצליח, לא רק שנעשיר את עצמנו, מי ייתן וגם נעשיר עוד מקומות בארצות הברית.
בבקשה לגשת לאלו שנמצאים בקבוצה א', מתחילים עכשיו בחדר 21 את הלימודים. הערב הלימודים יהיו מצומצמים יותר מרגיל, קודם כל כי התחלנו יותר מאוחר, ושנית פרופסור רביאניס פרדס פה הוא עייף מאוד כמובן, ואני חושב שאנחנו לא נקשה עליו בפעם הראשונה. לכן בבקשה לגשת מהר, חדר 21, ואלו מכם שלא נמצאים בקבוצה א', אתם תתחילו לאכול, שבע, אולי כדאי לכם ללמוד, בינתיים אין לכם עבודות בית, אז ללמוד בינתיים, ויש ארוחת ערב בשעה 7:15, אני חושב לכולם. שלום.
האם מישהו מוכן להביא אותי לחדר 21? אני לא יודע איפה זה. מישהו מקודם?
תודה רבה.
There was a wizard, and he had two sons. And he decided that in order to give them the opportunity to grow the way they must, and to test their mettle, he would create a world. And he would give them both an opportunity to grow within it. And so on a blazing sunny day, he walked out to a field, and in this field he made a world and inserted his two children. And then as they woke up and gained consciousness in this world, no memories, no awareness of what had passed, they heard a voice. And the voice told them that whoever will grow and watch this world best will be the one to whom the world will be bequeathed. Do not hurt it. And that's what they heard. Now this was a world that was very different from ours in certain ways. The boys woke up and they found themselves surrounded by all kinds of wonderful things. They felt a warm breeze on their face, and there were birds that were singing, and they heard water running very nearby, and there was a spray that was hitting them. And they could feel the sand underneath them, and yet at the same time, they were surrounded by the velvet touch of flowers. And all of this came with only a very vague perception of what was around them, because you see, this world had no sun. And so everything that they had, and all of the senses that they had to come through them other than through sight. But they didn't stumble. They could find their way, because after all, being wizards' children, they did have some type of extrasensory perception, and so they could sense when they were near something and when there was a hole and when there was a path, and never ever did they bump into a tree or lose their way. And they heard in the distance the sound of children laughing and playing, and decided to make their way to the house and to see if they could find lodging for themselves and to begin their work on this new world. Now the older boy was full of excitement, and he came and he met these children, and he took out this little bag that he had with him, again as a wizard's son who always come equipped with a little magic bag, and in it there were these magic crystals, which if they put them into their mouth, and the kids would just have this marvelous sensation of all kinds of delicious tastes and smells and tingles. And he gave them to the kids, and they were so excited with these magic crystals, and it made them feel strong, happy. And so they ran into the house, and they told their parents that someone had come along and had all these fantastic goodies. And they invited them into the house, and they sat them down and asked them questions and enjoyed the magic crystals that they would give out at various intervals. And the older boy was really very, very happy. He fell in love with his people and with the world that he had found. And he enjoyed very much just sitting around outside and listening to the birds. There was constantly a sound of ringing music in the air, very lightly in the background. And he would just enjoy running his fingers through the sand and feeling the flowers go through his hair. And he had a marvelous, marvelous time. And every time that they would get together in the house, he would sit down and he would talk to the people, and he would tell them how much he enjoyed them and how much he admires them and how much he appreciates this world that is theirs. And nothing could have made him happier than to stay there forever. And yet somehow the younger brother was filled with a sense of a vague dissatisfaction. He never could really bring himself to like it. He always felt that it was somehow lacking, it was somehow empty. And they tried to open him up, and they tried to get him to share the magic crystals with them too, of course, which he had. And he never responded, until finally one day they were all sitting around the table, and the older brother said to the younger brother, "Oh really, they're right, you know. You should open up, and you should become part of all of this." And at that he got very angry. He jumped up and he says, "You admire them so much because they admire your magic crystals." He stalked out of the room, and all the people just to themselves, and they said, "So ugly, he's so jealous." And this went on for quite a while. The younger brother from that time on really felt only sadness. And he could never bring himself to ever be happy there. The more he thought, and the more he felt about what was going on, the sadder he became. And in a way, his sadness was borne out because as time wore on, something very strange happened. It seems that the original stores of goods and bounties that this world had been provided with was getting used up. And that although until that time they'd always been used to fields that would produce all kinds of delicious things, and all they had to do was go out and to take whatever was produced, each year a little bit less started to grow. And each year the quality became a little bit lower. Until finally they recognized that they were in danger of starvation, and that if something wasn't done soon, they would have nothing at all. And so the older brother, who realized that, after all, he himself was very central. He had to make things work because he was the one that everybody admired so much and came to. And he was the one that apparently was going to inherit the world. He decided that he would have to go and he would have to see to it that things would work out. And so he told them, look, there must be some kind of storehouse that was provided you for such a possibility. Let's look around. Let's go outside and find it. And so they walked around, because you understand that not ever seeing anything, they would only bump into the things that were right in front of them. So they walked around until suddenly they found this little hut. And on front of the hut, it says there, to be open in time of need. Well, they went inside and they came in and they found it was full of all kinds of bags. And they opened up these bags and every bag had the same thing inside of it. All they could find was these little round things. And they had no idea what they were supposed to be. And so meanwhile, other people were starting to starve. And although normally visitors were far and few between because they didn't really know too much about what was outside of their own little world, not being able to see. And even if they would have, they weren't the type that enjoyed visiting very much. But hunger drove them out. And people started to come in. People were searching for food and something to live. And he would tell all of them, and he would order them to go back and to search their own area and to find out if they too had one of these enter in time of need kind of affairs. And sure enough, they all walked back and they would come and they would report to him. And they told him that we found something, and it turned out that everyone found something different inside their little storehouses. But each one only found one thing. And they would describe it to him, and of course, the things that they would describe, I suppose we would call plows and hose and fertilizer and so on and so forth, but they had no way of knowing what it was. And so you can imagine that if they missed what seeds were in the first storehouse, they certainly had no idea what some of these other esoteric items were for. But he ordered them to bring them all to him, and that he was going to work on it, and he would discover how these things were to be used. For after all, if it said on the door, enter in time of need, it must be that somehow in these different implements was the answer to their problem, and they would be able to produce food. And so he builds this enormous tower, because by now there are people that are coming in constantly to see it. And he goes up to the top of his tower as often as he can, because it's that he enjoys the most. Because really, his life revolved around enjoying all the sensations and the sights of this marvelous world. And he really begrudges all of the time that this is beginning to take from him in meeting all of these people and finding out what it is that they have. Nonetheless, he has an enormous sense of duty. After all, it's very important that he make it go, because he's going to inherit it all. And so, at the bottom of his tower, he has rooms, storage rooms, for all of these things that are being brought in and all the different implements that can be used. And he sets up this enormous laboratory. And in his laboratory, he examines each individual thing that's brought in, and he makes tremendous charts, and he has scientists working with him all the time that he trains to figure out what these things are for. And finally, he develops, after a lot of experiments, a system whereby he can actually produce food. And he figures out what has to be done at what stage and at what point. And things actually begin growing from the ground again because of the things that he has done. And he realizes that he's found the solution. He's very, very happy. He calls in his younger brother into the tower. He shows him all of these things. And he says, you know, the people here are so incapable, so incompetent, and that it's really providential that they have me here, because at least there's somebody who cares about them and who can make things work, who can get them out of this mess. And so the younger brother felt even sadder when he saw the new successes of his brother, that he had grown food. And he walked out, sadder still. So the older brother calls everybody together and he tells them, look, I have the solution. Each one of you must take a job. Some of you will plow the land, and some of you will sow the land, and some of you will eradicate the weeds, and some of you will fertilize the land, and some of you will water it. And he gives everybody exactly what job they have to have. And he has thousands and thousands of people that are working. And they, of course, having never done this before, they don't understand why in the world it's so important to do all these crazy things to produce food. They never before had to dig holes in order to produce food, and they never before had to water things to produce food. But he insisted that it be done this way. And he told them that if they will do it as he says, then he can help them. There's no other way that it can succeed. And because it was so important that he be aware of what was going on all over his dominion, he had this chair built for himself so that he could get wherever he needed to go. And he had it put on poles, and he had 8 people that were carrying him around. They were taking him to see the various things that needed doing. But he sort of enjoyed seeing the fields that had begun to grow and had begun to work and were actually producing food. And less were the times that he would go and journey out to further places that nothing had been done for yet and that still needed to have the ground broken for this tremendous project of building food. Instead, he liked to see that which he had accomplished, and he had them bring his chair there very often. As time went by, people began to resent him. They resented the fact that he so arbitrarily gave them these jobs to do, jobs that they didn't really understand and couldn't appreciate. That he didn't give them any choice in how it was they were supposed to grow their food and what it was that each one of them was supposed to do. And they didn't like the fact that there were fields that he wasn't interested in either. Many things about him they resented. And they tried to come to him, to speak to him, to give him new ideas. And nothing happened. He didn't listen. He wasn't interested. And so little by little, they began to rebel. And the people that were supposed to plant the little round things into the ground refused to do it in some of the fields. And in other fields, the people that were supposed to water refused to do it. And people began doing everyone else's job. And in the end, the crops began to fail. And nothing was growing again. And they were going back into a situation where only starvation would result. And so he decided that he has to go and he has to find supervisors and overseers that would see to it that everybody was going to do their job and that they wouldn't all starve. And so he gathers a police force and they were together. And he tells them that they absolutely must keep it going, because otherwise they're all going to starve. And anybody that doesn't do his job is to be taken out and publicly lashed. And so this goes on for a while. And the more he tries, the more resentful they become. And the more they insist on doing it their own way. And the more they destroy the fields, and the less food is growing. And he becomes more and more ruthless. He goes up to his tower, and he stays longer and longer times. And less does he go about to see what it is that can be done in the other fields, and how it is that he's going to help them grow. Let me just take a moment to ask you people who are writing, you people who may be thinking too much, it's very important for you not to try to find any remuzzling in this story. Because if you do, you won't understand the story. You'll be too busy trying to figure out remuzzling. They probably will be wrong. So just take the story as a story, because it's the overall story that's important. And the particulars you can worry about some other time. But just sit back and listen, and I hope ultimately enjoy it. Now the brother, through all of this, felt that something was very, very wrong. And as he watched his brother, his older brother, refused to take anyone's suggestion, and as he watched his older brother become more and more insistent that it be done his way, he became more and more disgusted and more upset. And one day, he watched, and somebody had come into the tower among the various people that were there to plead their cause for that day. And the man said, "You know, I have an idea. Perhaps it's not absolutely imperative that we plant these weeds in order to nourish the seeds, and then afterwards we have to rip them out. Maybe it would work if we didn't plant the weeds altogether. Maybe the seeds would grow even better." And the response that the brother had to that was, "You fool! Don't you realize how much I've done for you and how much work I've put into this and how I've analyzed every last detail? Don't try to make things better. Enjoy the marvelous things that we have, and then it will work." And he took him out and he had him lashed because he was disturbing the work, because he had the chutzpah to suggest that maybe there was a better way to do things. He didn't have the proper kind of recognition and gratitude for all the marvelous things that had been done by the older brother. And at that, the younger brother decided that he had had enough. He gathered together a small group of people and he told them, "This is no way to live. None of you should even agree to go on for another moment like this. It's true, there are great risks. And maybe we don't understand exactly how it's going to be done. But let's go in, grab whatever implements and seeds and anything that we can take, and run for it. And perhaps we can do a better job." And so he speaks and gets enough people who are full of resentment and are willing finally to listen to him and to take him seriously. And he goes, they break into the tower, and before anybody can do anything, they've grabbed a couple of dozen plows and all kinds of other implements, and they run away, and they come to a new area where none of this has ever reached. Nobody knows anything of what has gone on. And all they know is that they are starving, and that the end is coming clear, and here are these new people coming, bringing with them their own requirements for new food and so on, and they come out, the people that live in this area, and they threaten them. And they warn them that if they come even a little bit closer, they're going to be killed and attacked. And at that, the younger brother realizes part of what has been driving him nuts about this whole world. And he gets up and he starts to shout, and he becomes very, very sure of himself for the first time, and he says, "Listen, the way you're going now, you're certainly going to die out. The food is growing less and less every year. If we only work together, we can make it go, because each one of us here has a different implement, which if we put together, we're going to have food. And therefore, for your own sakes, have enough intelligence to work together. You shouldn't even need anyone to boss you around or to tell you how to do it. Let us work, let's try it out and see if anything grows. And if it doesn't, then we'll leave." So he finally manages to persuade them that this is what needs to be done. They get together and they plant and they water and they dig up the weeds and do whatever was required to be done. And finally, little by little, sure enough, the field begins to turn green. And you see that things are beginning to sprout. And later on, when everyone has gone into their homes, one fellow comes out, and he starts to put things out of the ground because he figures he's going to get whatever there is to get while the getting is good. If he sits there and waits any longer, there may be other people who have the same idea. But while he's pulling, you see, there are people coming from all directions who have all had the same idea. And of course, the second one finds the first one there, and the third one comes and finds the first two there, and they get into this enormous brawl until finally there are hundreds of people there that are sitting and beating each other and yelling and shouting. And this wakes up the younger brother, and he comes running and he sees all of this in front of him, and he says, "My God, it must be that my brother is right. There's no way that they can do it. It's impossible for them to cooperate. There's got to be someone who's going to do it for them." Yet on the other hand, a life like that, where everybody has to listen to him, is not a life that's worth living. Maybe better starvation than all of this. And so he becomes very brokenhearted because he doesn't understand what it is that he can do. he tells them that he has to think about it. And he insists they all go back to their homes, and they go back home. So after awakening, he gathers them all together under the ever-dark skies of Leek. That was the name of their world. And he thinks that he sees things really clearly for the first time. In a strong voice, he explains to them that we have been wrong just to try to train ourselves to do the things that need doing. And he sits and thinks for a moment, and he gets up, and he sends, decides he's going to make this magnificent speech, you see, and they're all going to finally hear what he has to say. And he says, "Friends, Leeks and Greeks, lend me your ears." And everybody perks up at that, not knowing exactly what it means. And he says, "We've been making an awful error. Ever since I've arrived on this world, I felt that something is wrong. And I think for the first time I realize what it is. We have no perception of the other on this world. Everything is completely mercenary. Each person is only interested in taking whatever it is that he can take for himself. What we lack is some kind of sense, a sense that will enable us to see each individual as an individual and yet as part of our whole world." And at that point, some very proud man of Leek stands up in the back of the audience and says, "It's rather useless for us to discuss what senses we ought to have if we don't have them, and such a sense could never exist anyway. And so what is the point of our trying any further?" And he says, "My, do you honestly believe that our world was created only to starve out after its first few years? Undoubtedly, if this is the way our world was made, then it was made for us to continue living in it. And that means that somehow the idea of these storage houses, each one of which had something else within it, must be the clue to our survival. And it must be giving us a message. The message must be that there is a way that we can somehow perceive that all of us comprise the setting of each one's world. And therefore, each one of us must begin to be responsible and to care for that other, and thereby we can all have our world." And at that, everybody was very taken, because it was, after all, supremely logical. A world would not have been created that couldn't have gone on. The fact was that everyone was very individualistic and had a different implement in their storehouse, and it seemed to be saying exactly what he was saying. And so despite the fact that this was a tremendous change of everything that they had ever believed, they decided that they would indeed get together and work and try to grow their food. And so they did a tremendous job. Each and every one got up early and worked very, very hard and did more than he really should have done. Each one tried to do more than their share. And somehow, miraculously, by the end of a few hours, the fields were once again green, and they were growing very, very rapidly, so that even as they stood there, the food grew and matured and ripened, and there was an enormous bounty to be had. And you can imagine that everybody was exceedingly happy and joyful. And so, the first time in the history of Leek, they sat down and they actually had a dinner together, where everybody was preparing everyone else's food and serving and working, and there was a feeling of everyone sharing the enormous bounty of a world that would finally exist forever and ever. In the midst of this dinner, everybody suddenly stood up in utter amazement, completely confounded, and all around there was an electric silence, and the voice that boy remembered in the very first instant of his consciousness in that world suddenly spoke again. And it said, "This world you see for the first time, it is now yours." And all around, all of a sudden, they could see. And the brilliant sun of that field in which the world had first been created suddenly came through, as if this veil had been taken away, and they recognized that there was light. And all of the things that before had only been sounds and feelings suddenly resolved themselves into these most incredible glowing birds and insects and grass and flowers and skies and all different colors, and they just sat there enthralled. And you can imagine the shock of never having seen anything, and suddenly everything was there, and all of the things that they had only imagined to be and had vaguely perceived were suddenly right there in front of their very eyes. And in the distance, they could see the tower. And in the tower on top, where he was wont to sit, was the brother, the older brother. He got up and he started to motion to them, to shout to them. And yet, as he moved his mouth, no sounds came out. And as they looked at him, he became shadowy. And they looked, and in front of his front of their eyes, he just sort of faded away until there was nothing but a shimmer there, and finally there was nothing at all. And the younger brother got up and said, in a voice full of resignation and of sadness, he was a mean person with mean concerns, who viewed all as a means to himself, for he thought all is mine. He set himself apart, and in the end, he remains forever outside. And that was the end of the older brothers. So, they decided that they would make a tremendous banquet in honor of the man who had saved their planet. And they worked for many days, and they set up this sumptuous feast with a triumphant procession, an enormous stage, and the population of an entire planet who for only the first time had become aware of the fact that they were a population of an entire planet, who recognized that there were other people and other things to be seen on this marvelous world of theirs, all came to one enormous procession. And they walked with him and they played their music, and for miles and miles they marched until finally they stood on two sides as he walked up to the stage to make his acceptance speech. He was, after all, to be king of the world of Liga. And as he begins to speak, he notices that everything is beginning to get rather dark and dim. And he looks around and he says, "My God, what's happening to the sun?" And everybody says, "Absolutely nothing's happening to the sun. It's fine. Why, it's as bright as it's ever been. It's marvelous. It's glorious." And he doesn't think it's marvelous and glorious at all. As a matter of fact, with every passing moment, he can see less and less. And then suddenly, for the first time, it really hits him what it was that was wrong. And he turns to them and he says, "Foolish people, it's not I that should be thanked for all of this. It is you. After all, the glow that I am appreciating and the beauty that I'm appreciating, why, it's yours. It comes only because I can see you. And therefore, I must thank you for all of this. And I owe you all for this tremendous opportunity of enabling me to actually have played a part in bringing light and the ability to see for all of us." And as he spoke those words and really recognized the truth for the first time and wanted nothing of all of his honor for himself, he himself began to glow. And as they looked at him, he got brighter and brighter and brighter. Suddenly, as his face shone, he realized that he was no longer in the world of Leek. He looked around and he found himself in the field in which the world had been created originally. And there at his feet, suspended in the middle of another world, was the entire world of Leek beneath him. And everything that he had ever seen was very clear and was all there in miniature. But somehow he had grown beyond it. He had become a member of another world. And as that happened, he heard the voice again speak, and this time it was filled with such pride and such affection and such love. And it told him, "Now it's all yours." And he looked down, and at his feet, he finds a book. The book is leather bound and it's very old. And on it it says, World Book, Instruction Manual for Wizards and Others. And he picks it up and he starts to read through its pages. It's fascinating. And he can barely drag himself away from this book, but after all, he does have responsibilities and cares and love for the world of Leek. And he goes back, and he begins to bring them the most marvelous thing from this new greater world in which he lives. And all the things that they were lacking, he finds. And he's mefarnished them. And he makes things so much more beautiful than they ever were before. And they, in turn, recognize that he has grown, that he has grown far, far beyond them. And the only thing that they can imagine that they can do for him is to make him a marvelous set of clothes. And this set of clothes, they embroider with everything that they have found that glows on their planet of Leek. All of the things that he, for the first time, has enabled them to see. All of the flowers and all of the birds and all of the people, all of the lovely mountains and water. They put it all into this clothing with the cares and concerns that they all had now for the new world that they had found. Until so much love and so much devotion was put into that coat that it itself shone the same way that he did. And whenever he would put it on, wherever he would go, even in this new world of his, in the broader world of his, he brought along with him such a light and such a clarity and such a care and concern and love for everything around him that he became famous all over the new world. Became famous as the man who represented Leek. And whenever he would go back there, they were so proud and enjoyed so much the new things that he brought them. And he spent many, many years doing this, and many years reading the book that he had found, that his father had left him, when he bequeathed to him these worlds. And yet in his pain, he began to realize more and more that in a way he was doing the same thing that he had been doing back on Leek. Because here he was viewing everything as being so separate and so different, and never giving a thought to what the whole was, and how did these various parts of his new world, how did they relate to each other, and what did they mean? And one day, as he was thinking, he was in the field and he was reading, and it suddenly hit him what the answer was, and at that moment, he realized that he wasn't in that world anymore at all. He found himself in a completely new world. And inside of that world, he saw the entire world that included the world of Leek underneath him, in miniature. And everything, again, was very, very clear. But the difference was at this time, there was no sun, and there was no sky, there were no stars, there was no moon, there was nothing. Everywhere he looked, the only thing that there was this incredible light, a light of a totally different quality than anything that he had seen before. And everything that he looked at, why he could see all of its history in that light, all of its past and all of its future, and not only its own past and future, but also through it the past and future of everything else that had existed in all of the worlds. And he was so shocked, he was so amazed, so happy and full of joy at being in this world, that it was with a start that he realized and began to wonder what he would have to do to go to the next. End of the story. Well, believe it or not, that is the story of Chanukah with many, many different Ramazim, and with a great deal of clarity, which is why it seems so far from what you're used to as Chanukah. But that's really it. I'll let the story sink in for a while, and then maybe next year we'll discuss its period.
What? No. Really? Really?